Well, that was a wonderful set of presentations, and I think that they're so complementary. And your last presentation by Rick, I think, really gave us, I think, was a bracing dose of reality. very, very, very stimulating. And I have to, before I start posing some questions to the panel, I can't suppress making some comments because I have to say I feel that CSUMB is really being validated by some of the things that have been said here today, particularly the way that we're working to lead a cradle-to-career educational partnership with K-12 and other stakeholders in our county, and also we're also being mindful of the fact that this connects to the workplace, to the creation of jobs, and to the future economic development of the region. And so we're very fortunate to be working in tandem with the Monterey Bay Economic Partnership that is doing good work in connecting communities around the Monterey Bay area, beyond Monterey County, including Santa Cruz and San Benito counties. So that's good news to hear that we're on the right track. I also can't help but make a teasing comment to Tim. You know, you had that that slide with all of the bubbles that were eventually aligned. You left out UC.
It's because Tim and I know each other a long time. So.
That's right.
So
yeah.
CSU, he gets a dig in every time.
I had it on there because Chris was here. I took it off. So.
The other thing that Chris mentioned is the critical role of early childhood education. And I think that's also very validating for us. We're working very closely with the Early Childhood Development Initiative in the county. And in fact, the work that's gone on in our Bright Futures partnership so far has identified about 7 critical indicators to focus on, but 2 I would call the tent poles of the effort. And one of them is being college and career ready when you come out of high school. That transition is critical. But the other one is childcare and having kids ready for kindergarten. So that's those are going to be the 2 biggest ones that we're going to focus on initially. I also wanted to make another sort of nitpicky economist comment. I looked at that graph that you put up with that shows the correlation between the racial generation gap and the level of educational spending. And you're right, you know, that the line that best fits all those points shows that inverse relationship. But there was a lot of variation between states that wasn't accounted for that. Mm. So it does show that this is not an iron law, that a lot of other factors can influence that. And so it gives us hope that by introducing other factors, political will, cultural factors, building community bonds, we can actually influence that in directions that wouldn't be predicted by that relationship. And then I thought Rick's point is critical for us in terms of the role that we can play in the education sector vis-a-vis the county, which is that right now you've got a critical shortage of unskilled labor, but in fact you're automating as quickly as you can. And it's clear that the direction is for those kinds of jobs to go down in number. And the more you automate it, the more you use technology, the greater there will be the need for the skilled workforce that we're preparing here. So I think that, I think that seems to be pointing us in the right direction. So let's talk about, and we've got some questions that are being collected, but I have a few here now. Have I preempted them all with my comments? Let's see.
Big stack.
Okay.
Wow.
All right, we'll go with these since they got here in time. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's a very, very specific question just to warm things up. Rick, there's a question for Tanimura and Antle, which is the housing that you've developed open for male and female workers?
Yes, it's for both male and female.
Okay. And here's a long one. Let's see. So for those of us who hope to take advantage of new employment opportunities by replacing retiring baby boomers, should we be prepared to discover, is there a danger that a significant percentage of these jobs may actually be eliminated as people retire? Or will enough new jobs be created to make up for those that will be eliminated? I guess it's a question for the economists in the group, huh?
Yeah, you know, I forgot to mention with that beautiful smiley face chart that I had that, you know, these are economists who are forecasting ahead 15, 20 years from now. And you probably know why economists invented forecasting. It was to make weather forecasters look good. No one can predict the future. And part of what they're looking at is, you know, where automatic algorithms are, artificial intelligence, kind of machine learning, and just trying to project forward of what's happening with that. And I think we can all see it. I mean, I forgot to go through the details of those occupations, but, you know, some of the occupations that are most likely to disappear are in the office administrative functions, the kinds of things that could be taken care of through automatic voice recognition systems and, being able to talk to your computer rather than typing. Much of that has already been lost. Driving positions with self-driving cars, that is part of that, and truck drivers is probably the first place that that's going to happen on sort of interstate long-distance trucking. And we can imagine in 10 to 15 years those kind of jobs are going. I have not done an analysis that looks at those occupations looking at the age profile of who's employed in them, so I don't have a direct answer to that question. But I think the key point is we have to stop thinking about the job. We have to think about work and livelihoods. Because work is about how do we, what are the skills and knowledge and social relationships and engagement that people engage in to create value in the economy. And we want to be maximizing that. And we want to take the full advantage of technology to create the kind of abundant, sustainable economy that we can imagine. And then we have to figure out how everyone in our society, as a basic human right of existence in our society, has at least a minimum basic livelihood to survive, as well as the incentives to pursue, work moving ahead. And so that's why, we can talk about jobs, and jobs are important, but I think we need to also be talking about all the other livelihood factors that are part of that as well.
So that's a very, you've opened up a whole new line of conversation that's very intriguing to me, but it might take us a bit far afield from workforce preparation. So before I go there, let me ask you a little more focused question, which is the assumption in trying to forecast future occupations and what's going to happen to them is that that the jobs are created first and then people will or will not be available to meet them. But there is also another approach, which our fellow economists that published the book, The Race Between Education and Technology, also pointed out that sometimes the skilled labor force can lead the job creation and can influence the type of jobs that are created. If you've got the skilled labor force, then skilled occupations or skilled activities will emerge, will be capitalized on by firms. So how important is that factor, and should we be, in terms of regional development in this region, should we say, the heck with it, let's train the workforce and the jobs will come? Can the skilled labor, in fact, create an opportunity for jobs being moving to the area to take advantage of them? How important is that
factor? The point I would make is actually bring in one that Rick talked about, which is the motivation of people in the workforce is absolutely critical.
in identifying new innovations and creating new markets. And I think that's true at every level. I mean, people who are picking strawberries are tremendously skilled. And often the whole system of harvesting and the kinds of technologies that are used in that to improve their productivity, you know, it's the people actually picking the lettuce and the strawberries, et cetera, that can give tremendous insight into how to structure the harvesting machines and designs in ways that can maximize their labor. So it's not just the highly skilled workforce that can provide innovations that create new economic value. I think we can see that across labor market spectrums. And you know, I think your point of getting away from the model of, oh, here's the demand in the labor market, how do we provide the supply, to a system that recognizes we need communication signals back and forth all the time, and that, you know, as you pointed out, the growth in the economy can be as much driven by you know, the workforce and people working as the higher levels in the company as well.
Okay, good. Back to Rick, I want to ask you a question here that was very specific from the audience. Do the salaries that were shown, such as $30,000 for a harvester and $40,000 for a row person, do those include benefits such as healthcare, retirement for TNA workers?
So those are just the base pay. And so everybody, since 1982, we've provided a full medical benefit program. We have a retirement program, vacation pay, bereavement pay, jury pay. So those are just the absolute basis. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. More. All right. Well, the question, I mean, there's several questions that have been suggested around the issue of immigration. How does this play into it? What impact would, how do you see whether we develop some sort of a path toward legalization, you know, for the undocumented workers here, would that impact the situation in our county in terms of the workforce, or even in California? I would open it up to anybody, any one of you, to comment on that.
Yeah, I'll just say that a couple of different things. One is that, as I alluded to in my talk, I think the international ties and connections is a critical part of thinking about growth going forward, and that we should be encouraging sort of greater movement of people back and forth, because that'll strengthen those economic ties. We also know that immigrants of all ethnicities tend to be more entrepreneurial than U.S.-born people of the same ethnicities. Greater levels of self-employment, greater levels of new business creation. Sometimes that's out of necessity because of not being able to work legally, but often it comes from just a certain amount of self-selection, that people are willing to take the risk to move to another country, tend to be those, you know, real go-getters and movers as well. Our colleague Manuel Pastor has done some calculations about the economic boost that would come from legalization and a path to citizenship of undocumented residents of our country. And I don't have the figures at the top of my head, but even in California, there's a very significant economic boost that would come from a path to citizenship, because it means that people could, you know, earn what would be a normal wage in the positions that they're working in, which leads to greater consumer power and all that goes along with that. So I think simply from economic considerations, much less the human rights issue, there's a very strong argument for path to citizenship and, you know, responsible increasing growth in immigration, I would say.
So here's a very interesting question from another practitioner. What advice would you give a career pathway coach who's new at his job to give to an at-risk youth between 16 and 24 in our communities? And these youth are currently working towards a high school diploma.
Who said that? I mean, I'm so glad that there's somebody in the audience working with at-risk youth. I mean, one of the biggest challenges in all across the state is the level of disconnection, right? That's youth who are neither in school nor in a job. I mean, the numbers are so high that it just points to this incredible tragedy across the state of California. So if you're working with at-risk youth, Hats off to you. It's very difficult, challenging work. There are resources available, obviously, locally to help young people access education and training to get them on a good career path. So there's a question where you want to send them in terms of a good job, career path. Yeah.
Right here. I mean, they're getting their diploma.
Yeah.
While they're currently being potentially influenced to go into higher education or vocational training. And so just kind of where you see our region's, you know, just potential. Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know, just any advice how you would approach at-risk youth as opposed to students that may already have some pathway.
Right, both. I would say it's not either or, it's both and. A vocational pathway is a good one. There are lots of job openings for workers who have less than a bachelor's degree, but some level of training beyond high school. That's what we call middle skill. In fact, the retirements that are coming over the next 10 years, that's impacting that middle skill probably more than anything else, even the high skill. But opportunities around education and training where that individual is going to have a vocation and a potential career there, but the opportunity the opportunity to pursue higher education so he or she can get a bachelor's degree later is the way you want to sort of set it up. A vocational pathway is a great one. My brother is an electrician, and he makes twice as much money as I do. He didn't go to college. I shouldn't have. I don't know why I went to college. Mm-hmm. Should have been an electrician, which is a great occupation because it's a broad skill set and you can work in many different applications across industry sectors. My brother makes $120,000 a year as an electrician. And there are huge openings in the trades because of retirements, but also because of growth. So let's talk. Or I guess we already did. Huh?
Hey. So another question that's specific to for Rick is: does Tannen Moore and Antel have an R&D department in terms of technology that you use?
Everybody, the workforce is R&D. When it comes down to it, I think you guys you touched on a lot of what we learn is what the workers feedback from the workers and things. But as far as having somebody with a title that says research and development, it's everybody in the company, really.
Yeah, and that's for those of us who are students of the history of technology, that's how the Industrial Revolution took place.
That's right.
Trial and error and watching what everybody else was doing.
We have a big bone pile. That's where you build a machine and doesn't work, so you put it in back. And then later, you're building a new machine, and you think, "Oh, I got something out of there." So,
bone pile.
Another question here is there any impact, either adverse or positive, of automation to the cultivation of organic products or to the carbon footprint that's generated by the production process? How does automation factor into that one way or the other? Or does it?
The carbon footprint,
are you going to have a lot of machines putting out a lot of, smog?
Well, you have one machine that's doing the work that maybe a crew of 20 who each drove their car to work because they didn't want to ride the bus because they would have had to get up an hour earlier. So I would probably tell you that it's going to reduce it significantly.
And does the more extensive use of automation hinder or affect in any way the ease of cultivating organic products as opposed to products that rely on
over time over time it should not. I mean, if you have a good cultural practice in your organic farm, you'll be able to easily adapt it.
Okay.
I wondered if you wanted to mention your greenhouse production. I found some of that really interesting.
So we do have a sustainable, locally grown product that we produce. We actually produce it in Tennessee, though, and it's grown in a greenhouse. We have a 15 acres of greenhouse that's produces 30 to 40 times its what its outdoor acreage would be. So it's like the equivalent of having 450 to 500 acres under production during the course of a year. And We use 95% less water, 95% less inputs. We have a little bit higher energy costs, but that's offset by not having to truck it from the East Coast or from the West Coast to the East Coast. So that is a movement that's afoot. You hear a lot about vertical farms and going into a warehouse, and those are very, very labor or very, very energy intensive. They're typically not growing a full head of lettuce. It's the little baby greens sort of thing. It's got a nice buzz. A lot of trust fund babies are putting their money into it because they make it feel good. They're a farmer today, but sunshine's free, right? So we build our greenhouses based on maximizing what we can get from the sun. So recently, last Sunday, it was 67 degrees and a very breezy day. And when the breezes hit over 12 miles an hour, the vents have to close. And when the vents close, the temperature spiked to 102 degrees. And so that's how intense the light can actually be in a greenhouse. So learning how to harness it. We've had the greenhouse now for 9 years, and we continue to amaze ourselves by how stupid we were and why were we doing it this way, and we continue to learn. So.
Excellent.
R&D. Yeah, the hard way.
So, Tim, going back to you, as I said, we were very gratified to hear that we're doing the right things as far as you're concerned at the state level. So given that you're blessing our activities here, is there any chance of support from the state?
Remember, you're on camera now, Tim.
Absolutely. No, we've made a connection, and we call this regional coalition development thing Slingshot, which is an odd name for, well, you know about it. We work together. It's called Slingshot, and which is a weird term for building partnerships. You don't normally sort of shoot your partner with a slingshot. The idea is we want to find good coalition work already going that we can invest in to sort of accelerate using our limited funds to do that. So for me, I am very excited about the opportunity to take credit for your good work.
Okay. So now looking a little more broadly at these issues, we have a question here that has brought up the issue of technological change and the fact that, with the explosion of computing power, we're going to have artificial intelligence. Within a couple of decades, maybe 30 years, it might exceed human intelligence. And what implications does that have for the workplace, for the workforce?
I don't know.
Next question.
I guess the point I would make about that is, maybe things are different this time, right? There are aspects of computerization that are completely unprecedented. But that's what people said, when we had, 90% of our workforce in agriculture. And what are we going to do when we automate agriculture? And where are people going to have jobs? And they got jobs in the factories, right? And then what do we do when we're able to automate our assembly lines? Where are people going to work? And we discovered, YouTube and Facebook and Netflix and entertainment, all the things that are part of that. So I'm actually quite optimistic. I think there's no limit to human creativity and innovation. And if we're living in a society where basic needs are covered, then, we're talking about a Maslow's, hierarchy of needs, where we're looking at entertainment industries and service industries and tourism and all the things that are part of that. And I don't see a limit to the types of jobs that are potential in that kind of world. I can't predict what they're going to be 30 years from now. Mm-hmm. But I think the challenge is not technology. I think the challenge is our social and political institutions. Mm-hmm. When we have this amazing planter out there that's doing the work of 50 previous farmers, I'm very excited by that. I think that's a tremendous advancement in use of technology. And we need to figure out sort of what are the ways that people whose jobs are displaced get the new connections, get the new skills, are able to move into other economic opportunities. So it's not to minimize the very real human costs and disruptions that are part of technological change. But it's not a technological challenge, it's a social challenge that I think we as a society and people are up to the challenge, because I tend to be an optimistic guy.
So you're sort of alluding to the fact that, well, first of all, a nod to previous discussions of technological innovation that were, the answer has always been, oh, but invariably there will be more jobs created than are eliminated by the new technology, mm-hmm. so we don't have to worry about the end of work. Mm-hmm. But as you said, this time it might be different, mm-hmm. right? Because of the incredible explosion in computing power and the fact that information and the processing of it underlies so much of the effort of production and distribution of goods.
Right.
So in effect, I think your answer is also hinting at an answer to this question, which I think is the really important one for us humans. Is there any way to measure progress besides economic growth?
Mm.
And you know, and could it be that we're entering an era where there will be we will start decoupling, you know, jobs from progress, from human flourishing, and all of that kind of stuff. Mm. So that one's wide open there. You know, anybody want to take a shot at that one?
I just have to say it's so interesting you asked that question, whoever asked that, because I'm actually involved literally at the moment we're speaking. I have research assistants that are working on a project with the Rockefeller Foundation that's trying to develop indicators for inclusive economies. And they're very explicitly not using the term inclusive growth, because they're trying to think about how do we measure economic change in a way that recognizes the importance of inclusion and develops indicators, real measurements around that. So I'm deeply steeped into lots and lots of indicators around that. They've developed a criteria that says that an inclusive economy should be equitable, it should be participatory. And that's participatory in governance institutions, but also in having control and influence over the decisions about how markets are organized, and participation as consumers and business owners as well as workers. It should be growing, but growing in ways that are transforming for greater human well-being. And so we're looking at actually measures of well-being that are part of that. It should be sustainable. And I have to say the indicator that we're struggling the most with, that they want us to come up with, is decision-making taking account of long-term consequences for those decision-making. Mm-hmm. So in principle, we can imagine it, but how do you measure that? We don't know. And then the fifth category is stable. How do you have an economy that, you know, provides stability in people's lives and avoids the kind of volatility and up and down of our typical economy? People might be interested in something called the genuine progress indicator, which is an effort that's been around for at least 25, 30 years along this lines. And they start with the measure of gross domestic product, GDP, our traditional economic growth measures. They add on to that unpaid labor, the value of unpaid labor. So working in the home, childcare, all those things that are critical for our economic functioning that aren't captured by the market. And they also add on to that environmental services, the ways that trees clean the air, the ways that, you know, water provides services for agriculture and for other industries. And then they subtract from it the costs of environmental pollution and the health issues that are part of that. You know, now if we have a toxic spill that creates health problems and people have increased health care costs because they're exposed to the toxics, all of that counts as a plus in our economic accounting. Yeah. Well, in fact, you should subtract all those environmental costs. And then they subtract the loss of leisure time, which is another one. So if you Google genuine progress indicator, there's, you know, efforts that are out there to really try and measure that. But I think what cuts across all of these is really an approach to thinking about human well-being and livelihoods rather than just this simple metric of GDP growth.